A week's thought made the idea of at least summering at the lake seem better than ever. So, on a Saturday afternoon in early May, when I calculated that any self-respecting Maine caretaker would be at home watching the Red Sox, I called Bill Dean and told him I'd be at my lake place from the 4th of July or so, and that if things went as I hoped, I'd be spending the fall and winter there as well. "Well, that's good," he said. "That's real good news. A lot of folks down here missed you, Mike. Quite a few that want to condole with you about your wife, don't you know?" Was there the faintest note of reproach in his voice, or was that just my imagination? Certainly Joe and I had cast a shadow in the area. We had made significant contributions to the little library which served the Mauton, Kashwakamak, Castleview area, and Joe had headed the successful fund drive to get an area bookmobile up and running. In addition to that, she had been part of a ladies' sewing circle, Afghans were her specialty, and a member in good standing of the Castle County Crafts Co-op. Visits to the sick, helping out with the annual volunteer fire department blood drive, womaning a booth during Summerfest in Castle Rock, and stuff like that was only where she had started. She didn't do it in any ostentatious Lady Bountiful way, either, but unobtrusively and humbly, with her head lowered, often to hide a rather sharp smile, I should add. My Joe had a Bercyan sense of humor. Christ, I thought, maybe old Bill had a right to sound reproachful. "People miss her," I said. "Yeah, they do. I still miss her a lot myself. I think that's why I've stayed away from the lake. That's where a lot of our good times were." "I suppose so, but it'll be damn good to see you down this way. I'll get busy. The place is all right. You could move into it this afternoon if you was a mind. But when a house has stood empty the way Sarah has, it gets stale." "I know. I'll get Brenda Meserve to clean the whole shebang from top to bottom. Same gal you always had, don't you know? Brenda's a little old for comprehensive spring cleaning, isn't she?" The lady in question was about 65, stout, kind, and gleefully vulgar. She was especially fond of jokes about the traveling salesman who spent the night like a rabbit, jumping from hole to hole. No Mrs. Danvers she. "Ladies like Brenda Meserve never get too old to oversee the festivities," Bill said. "She'll get two or three girls to do the vacuuming and heavy lifting. Set you back maybe $300. Sound all right?" "Like a bargain. The well needs to be tested, and the Jenny, too, although I'm sure both of 'em's okay. I seen a hornet's nest by Joe's old studio that I want to smoke before the woods get dry. Oh, and the roof of the center wing needs to be reshingled. I should have talked to you about that last year, but with you not using the place, I let a slide. You stand good for that, too?" "Yes, up to $10,000. Beyond that, call me." "If we have to go over $10,000, I'll smile and kiss a pig. Try to have it all done before I get down there, okay?" "Course. You'll want your privacy, I know that, just so long as you know you won't get any right away. We were shocked when she went so young. All of us were. Shocked and sad. She was a dear." From a Yankee mouth, that word rhymes with Leah. "Thank you, Bill." I felt tears prickle my eyes. Grief is like a drunken house guest, always coming back for one more goodbye hug. "Thanks for saying." "You'll get your share of carrot cakes, chummy." He laughed, but a little doubtfully, as if afraid he was committing an impropriety. "I can eat a lot of carrot cake," I said, "and if folks overdo it, well, hasn't Kenny Oster still got that big Irish wolfhound?"
"Yeah, that thing'd eat cake till he busted," Bill cried in high good humor.
He cackled until he was coughing. I waited, smiling a little myself. "Blueberry, he calls that dog. Damned if I know why. Ain't he the gormiest thing?" I assumed he meant the dog and not the dog's master. Kenny Oster, not much more than 5 feet tall and neatly made, was the opposite of gormy, that peculiar Maine adjective that means clumsy, awkward, and clay-footed. I suddenly realized that I missed these people. Bill and Brenda and Buddy Jellison and Kenny Oster and all the others who lived year-round at the lake. I even missed Blueberry the Irish wolfhound, who trotted everywhere with his head up just as if he had half a brain in it, and long strands of saliva depending from his jaws.
"I've also got to get down there and clean up the winter blowdown," Bill said. He sounded embarrassed. "It ain't bad this year. That last big storm was all snow over our way, thank God, but there's still a fair amount of happy crappy I ain't got to yet. I should have put it behind me long before now. You not using the place ain't an excuse. I've been cashing your checks."
There was something amusing about listening to the grizzled old fart beating his breast. Joe would have kicked her feet and giggled, I'm quite sure. "If everything's right and running by July 4th, Bill, I'll be happy."
"You'll be happy as a clam in a mud flat, then. That's a promise."
Bill sounded as happy as a clam in a mud flat himself, and I was glad.
"Going to come down and write a book by the water, like in the old days? Not that the last couple ain't been fine. My wife couldn't put that last one down, but..."
"I don't know," I said, which was the truth. And then an idea struck me. "Bill, would you do me a favor before you clean up the driveway and turn Brenda Meserve loose?"
"Happy to if I can," he said.
So I told him what I wanted. 4 days later, I got a little package with this laconic return address. "Dean, Jen DeLive, TR90 Dark Score." I opened it and shook out 20 photographs which had been taken with one of those little cameras you use once and then throw away. Bill had filled out the roll with various views of the house, most conveying that subtle air of neglect a place gets when it's not used enough. Even a place that's caretook, to use Bill's word, gets that neglected feel after a while. I barely glanced at these. The first four were the ones I wanted, and I lined them up on the kitchen table where the strong sunlight would fall directly on them. Bill had taken these from the top of the driveway, pointing the disposable camera down at the sprawl of Sarah Laff's. I could see the moss, which had grown not only on the logs of the main house, but on the logs of the north and south wings as well. I could see the litter of fallen branches and the drifts of pine needles on the driveway. Bill must have been tempted to clear all that away before taking his snaps, but he hadn't. I told him exactly what I wanted. "Warts and all" was the phrase I had used, and Bill had given it to me. The bushes on either side of the driveway had thickened a lot since Joe and I had spent any significant amount of time at the lake. They hadn't exactly run wild, but yes, some of the longer branches did seem to yearn toward each other across the asphalt like separated lovers. Yet what my eye came back to again and again was the stoop at the foot of the driveway. The other resemblances between the photographs and my dreams of Sarah Laff's might only be coincidental, or the writer's often surprisingly practical imagination at work. But I could explain the sunflowers growing out through the boards of the stoop no more than I had been able to explain the cut on the back of my hand. I turned one of the photos over. On the back, in a spidery script, Bill had written, "These fellas are way early and trespassing." I flipped back to the picture side. Three sunflowers growing up through the boards of the stoop. Not two, not four, but three large sunflowers with faces like searchlights. Just like the ones in my dream. On July 3rd of 1998, I threw two suitcases in my powerbook in the trunk of my mid-sized Chevrolet, started to back down the driveway, then stopped and went into the house again. It felt empty and somehow forlorn, like a faithful lover who has been dropped and cannot understand why. The furniture wasn't covered and the power was still on. I understood that the Great Lake experiment might turn out to be a swift and total failure. But 14 Benton Street felt deserted all the same. Rooms too full of furniture to echo still did when I walked through them. and everywhere there seemed to be too much dusty light. In my study, the VDT was hooded like an executioner against the dust. I knelt before it and opened one of the desk drawers. Inside were four reams of paper. I took one, started away with it under my arm, then had a second thought and turned back. I had put that provocative photo of Joe in her swimsuit in the wide center drawer. Now I took it, tore the paper wrapping from the end of the ream of paper, and slid the photo halfway in, like a bookmark. If I did perchance begin to write again, and if the writing marched, I would meet Joanna right around page 250. I left the house, locked the back door, got into my car, and drove away. I have never been back. I'd been tempted to go down to the lake and check out the work, which turned out to be quite a bit more extensive than Bill Dean had originally expected, on several occasions. What kept me away was a feeling, never quite articulated by my conscious mind but still very powerful, that I wasn't supposed to do it that way, that when I next came to Sarah, it should be to unpack and stay. Bill hired out Kenny Oster to shingle the roof and got Kenny's cousin, Timmy Larrabee, to scrape the old girl down, a cleansing process akin to pot scrubbing that is sometimes employed with log homes. Bill also had a plumber in to check out the pipes and got my okay to replace some of the older plumbing and the well pump. Bill fussed about all these expenses over the telephone. I let him. When it comes to fifth or sixth generation Yankees in the expenditure of money, you might as well just stand back and let them get it out of their systems. Laying out the green just seems wrong to a Yankee somehow, like petting in public. As for myself, I didn't mind the outgo a bit. I live frugally for the most part, not out of any moral code, but because my imagination, very lively in most other respects, doesn't work very well on the subject of money. My idea of a spree is 3 days in Boston, a Red Sox game, a trip to Tower Records and Video, plus a visit to the Wordsworth Bookstore in Cambridge. Living like that doesn't make much of a dent in the interest, let alone the principal. I had a good money manager down in Waterville, and on the day I locked the door of the dairy house and headed west to TR-90, I was worth slightly over $5 million. Not much compared to Bill Gates, but big numbers for this area, and I could afford to be cheerful about the high cost of house repairs. That was a strange late spring and early summer for me. What I did mostly was wait, close up my town affairs, talk to Bill Dean when he called with the latest round of problems, and try not to think. I did the Publishers Weekly interview, and when the interviewer asked me if I'd had any trouble getting back to work, in the wake of my bereavement, I said no with an absolutely straight face. Why not? It was true. My troubles hadn't started until I'd finished all the way from the top. Until then, I had been going on like gangbusters. In mid-June, I met Frank Arlen for lunch at the Starlight Cafe. The Starlight is in Lewiston, which is the geographical midpoint between his town and mine. Over dessert, the Starlight's famous strawberry shortcake, Frank asked if I was seeing anyone. I looked at him with surprise. "What are you gaping at?" he asked, his face registering one of the 900 unnamed emotions. This, one of those somewhere between amusement and irritation. "I certainly wouldn't think of it as two-time and Joe. She'll have been dead 4 years come August." "No," I said, "I'm not seeing anybody." He looked at me silently. I looked back for a few seconds, then started fiddling my spoon through the whipped cream on top of my shortcake. The biscuits were still warm from the oven, and the cream was melting. It made me think of that silly old song about how someone left the cake out in the rain. "Have you seen anybody, Mike?" "I'm not sure that's any business of yours." "Oh, for Christ's sake! On your vacation, did you—" I made myself look up from the melting whipped cream. "No," I said. "I did not." He was silent for another moment or two. I thought he was getting ready to move on to another topic. That would have been fine with me. Instead, he came right out and asked me if I'd been late at all since Joanna died. He would have accepted a lie on that subject, even if he didn't entirely believe it. Men lie about sex all the time. But I told the truth, and with a certain perverse pleasure. No. Not a single time? Not a single time. What about a massage parlor, you know, to at least get a... No.
He sat there, tapping his spoon against the rim of the bowl with his dessert in it. He hadn't taken a single bite. He was looking at me as though I were some new and oogie specimen of bug. I didn't like it much, but I suppose I understood it. I had been close to what is these days called a relationship on two occasions, neither of them on Key Largo, where I had observed roughly 2,000 pretty women walking around dressed in only a stitch and a promise. Once it had been a red-haired waitress, Kelly, at a restaurant out on the extension where I often have lunch. After a while, we got talking, joking around, and then there started to be some of that eye contact. You know the kind I'm talking about, looks that go on just a little too long. I started to notice her legs and the way her uniform pulled against her hip when she turned, and she noticed me noticing. And there was a woman at New U, the place where I used to work out, a tall woman who favored pink jog bras and black bike shorts, quite yummy. Also, I liked the stuff she brought to read while she pedaled one of the stationary bikes on those endless aerobic trips to nowhere. Not Mademoiselle or Cosmo, but novels by people like John Irving and Ellen Gilchrist. I like people who read actual books, and not just because I once wrote them myself. Book readers are just as willing as anyone else to start out with the weather, but as a general rule, they can actually go on from there. The name of the blonde in the pink tops and black shorts was Adria Bundy. We started talking about books as we pedaled side by side ever deeper into nowhere, and there came a point where I was spotting her one or two mornings a week in the weight room. There's something oddly intimate about spotting. The prone position of the lifter is part of it, I suppose, especially when the lifter is a woman, but not all or even most of it. Mostly, it's the dependence factor. Although it hardly ever comes to that point, the lifter is trusting the spotter with his or her life. And at some point in the winter of 1996, those looks started as she lay on the bench and I stood over her, looking down into her upside-down face, the ones that go on just a little too long. Kelly was around 30, Adria perhaps a little younger. Kelly was divorced, Adria never married. In neither case would I have been robbing the cradle, and I think either would have been happy to go to bed with me on a provisional basis, kind of a honey-bump test drive. Yet what I did in Kelly's case was to find a different restaurant to eat my lunch at, and when the YMCA sent me a free exercise tryout offer, I took them up on it and just never went back to New U. I remember walking past Adria Bundy one day on the street, 6 months or so after I made the change, and although I said hi, I made sure not to see her puzzled, slightly hurt gaze. In a purely physical way, I wanted them both. In fact, I seemed to remember a dream in which I had them both, in the same bed and at the same time, and yet I wanted neither. Part of it was my inability to write. My life was quite fucked up enough, thank you, without adding any additional complications. Part of it was the work involved in making sure that the woman who is returning your glances is interested in you and not your rather extravagant bank account. Most of it, I think, was that there was just too much Joe still in my head and heart. There was no room for anyone else, even after 4 years. It was sorrow like cholesterol, and if you think that's funny or weird, be grateful. "What about friends?" Frank asked, at last beginning to eat his strawberry shortcake. "You've got friends, you see, don't you?" "Yes," I said, "plenty of friends." Which was a lie, but I did have lots of crosswords to do, lots of books to read, and lots of movies to watch on my VCR at night. I could practically recite the FBI warning about unlawful copying by heart. When it came to real-life people, the only ones I called when I got ready to leave Derry were my doctor and my dentist, and most of the mail I sent out that June consisted of change of address cards to magazines like Harper's and National Geographic. "Frank," I said, "you sound like a Jewish mother.
"Sometimes when I'm with you, I feel like a Jewish mother," he said, "one who believes in the curative powers of baked potatoes instead of matzo balls. You look better than you have in a long time. Finally put on some weight, I think."
"Too much."
"Bullshit. You look like Ichabod Crane when you came for Christmas. Also, you got some sun on your face and arms."
"I've been walking a lot."
"So you look better, except for your eyes. Sometimes you get this look in your eyes, and I worry about you every time I see it. I think Joe would be glad someone's worrying."
"What look is this?" I asked.
"Your basic thousand-yard stare. Want the truth? You look like someone who's caught on something and can't get loose." I left Derry at 3:30, stopped in Rumford for supper, then drove slowly on through the rising hills of western Maine as the sun lowered. I had planned my times of departure and arrival carefully, if not quite consciously, and as I passed out of Mauton and into the unincorporated township of TR-90, I became aware of the heavy way my heart was beating. There was sweat on my face and arms in spite of the car's air conditioning. Nothing on the radio sounded right, all the music like screaming, and I turned it off. I was scared, and had good reason to be. Even setting aside the peculiar cross-pollination between the dreams and things in the real world, as I was able to do quite easily, dismissing the cut on my hand and the sunflowers growing through the boards of the back stoop as either coincidence or so much psychic fluff, I had reason to be scared, because they hadn't been ordinary dreams, and my decision to go back to the lake after all this time hadn't been an ordinary decision. I didn't feel like a modern fin de millenaire man on a spiritual quest to face his fears. "I'm okay, you're okay, let's all have an emotional circle jerk," while William Ackerman plays softly in the background. I felt more like some crazy Old Testament prophet going out into the desert to live on locusts and alkali water because God had summoned him in a dream. I was in trouble. My life was a moderate going on severe mess, and not being able to write was only part of it. I wasn't raping kids or running around Times Square preaching conspiracy theories through a bullhorn, but I was in trouble just the same. I had lost my place in things and couldn't find it again. No surprise there. After all, life's not a book. What I was engaging in on that hot July evening was self-induced shock therapy, and give me at least this much credit. I knew it. You come to Darkscore this way, I-95 from Derry to Newport, Route 2 from Newport to Bethel, with a stop in Rumford, which used to stink like hell's front porch until the paper-driven economy pretty much ground to a halt during Reagan's second term. Route 5 from Bethel to Waterford. Then you take Route 68, the old county road, across Castleview, through Mauton, where downtown consists of a converted barn which sells videos, beer, and second-hand rifles. And then past the sign which reads TR-90 and the one reading Game Warden is best assistance in emergency. Dial 1-800-555-GAME or *72 on cellular phone. To this, in spray paint, someone has added, "Fuck the Eagles." 5 miles past that sign, you come to a narrow lane on the right, marked only by a square of tin with the faded number 42 on it. Above this, like umlauts, are a couple of 22 holes. I turned into this lane just about when I had expected to. It was 7:16 p.m. EDT by the clock on the Chevrolet's dashboard. And the feeling was coming home. I drove in 0.2 miles by the odometer, listening to the grass which crowned the lane whickering against the undercarriage of my car, listening to the occasional branch which scraped across the roof or knocked on the passenger side like a fist. At last I parked and turned the engine off. I got out, walked to the rear of the car, laid down on my belly, and began pulling all of the grass which touched the Chevy's hot exhaust system. It had been a dry summer, and it was best to take precautions. I had come at this exact hour in order to replicate my dreams, hoping for some further insight into them, or for an idea of what to do next. What I had not come to do was start a forest fire. Once this was done, I stood up and looked around. The crickets sang as they had in my dreams, and the trees huddled close on either side of the lane, as they always did in my dreams. Overhead, the sky was a fading strip of blue. I set off, walking up the right-hand wheel rut. Joe and I had had one neighbor at this end of the road, old Lars Washburn, but now Lars's driveway was overgrown with juniper bushes and blocked by a rusty length of chain. Nailed to a tree on the left of the chain was a no trespassing sign. Nailed to one on the right was Next Century Real Estate and a local number. The words were faded and hard to read in the growing gloom. I walked on, once more conscious of my heavily beating heart and of the way the mosquitoes were buzzing around my face and arms. Their peak season was past, but I was sweating a lot, and that's a smell they like. It must remind them of blood. Just how scared was I as I approached Sarah Lapp's? I don't remember. I suspect that fright, like pain, is one of those things that slips our minds once it has passed. What I do remember is a feeling I'd had before when I was down here, especially when I was walking this road by myself. It was a sense that reality was thin. I think it is thin, you know, thin as lake ice after a thaw, and we fill our lives with noise and light and motion to hide that thinness from ourselves. But in places like Lane 42, you find that all the smoke and mirrors have been removed. What's left is the sound of crickets and the sight of green leaves darkening toward black, branches that make shapes like faces, the sound of your heart and your chest, the beat of the blood against the backs of your eyes, and the look of the sky as the day's blue blood runs out of its cheek. What comes in when daylight leaves is a kind of certainty, that beneath the skin there is a secret, some mystery both black and bright. You feel this mystery in every breath. You see it in every shadow. You expect to plunge into it at every turn of a step. It is here. You slip across it on a kind of breathless curve like a skater turning for home. I stopped for a moment about half a mile south of where I'd left the car and still half a mile north of the driveway. Here the road curves sharply, and on the right is an open field which slants steeply down toward the lake. Tidwell's Meadow is what the locals call it, or sometimes the old camp. It was here that Sarah Tidwell and her curious tribe built their cabins, at least according to Marie Hingerman. And once, when I asked Bill Dean, he agreed that this was the place, although he didn't seem interested in continuing the conversation, which struck me at the time as a bit odd. I stood there for a moment, looking down at the north end of Dark Score. The water was glassy and calm, still candy-colored in the afterglow of sunset, without a single ripple or a single small craft to be seen. The boat people would all be down at the marina or at Warrington Sunset Bar by now, I guessed, eating lobster rolls and drinking big mixed drinks. Later, a few of them, buzzed on speed and martinis, would go bolting up and down the lake by moonlight. I wondered if I would be around to hear them. I thought there was a fair chance that by then I'd be on my way back to Derry, either terrified by what I'd found or disillusioned because I had found nothing at all. "You funny little man," said Strickland. I didn't know I was going to speak until the words were out of my mouth, and why those words in particular I had no idea. I remembered my dream of Joe under the bed and shuddered. A mosquito whined in my ear. I slapped it and walked on. In the end, my arrival at the head of the driveway was almost too perfectly timed, the sense of having re-entered my dream almost too complete. Even the balloons tied to the Sarah Laughs sign, one white and one blue, both with "Welcome Back, Mike" carefully printed on them in black ink, and floating against the ever-darkening backdrop of the trees, seemed to intensify the déjà vu I had quite deliberately induced, for no two dreams are exactly the same, are they? Things made by hands and minds can never be quite the same, even when they try their best to be identical, because we're never the same from day to day, or even moment to moment. I walked to the sign, feeling the mystery of this place at twilight. I squeezed down on the board, feeling its rough reality, and then I ran the ball of my thumb over the letters, daring the splinters and reading with my skin like a blind man reading Braille. S and A and R and A, L and A and U and G and H and S. The driveway had been cleared of fallen needles and blown down branches, but dark score glimmered a fading rose, just as it had in my dreams, and the sprawled hulk of the house was the same. Bill had thoughtfully left the light over the back stoop burning, and the sunflowers growing through the boards had long since been cut down, but everything else was the same. I looked overhead at the slot of sky over the lane. Nothing. I waited. And nothing. Waiting still. And then, there it was, right where the center of my gaze had been trained. At one moment, there was only the fading sky, with indigo just starting to rise up from the edges like an infusion of ink. And at the next, Venus was glowing there, bright and steady. People talk about watching the stars come out, and I suppose some people do, but I think that was the only time in my life that I actually saw one appear. I wished on it, too, but this time it was real time, and I did not wish for Joe. Help me, I said, looking at the star. I would have said more, but I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what kind of help I needed. That's enough, a voice in my mind said uneasily. That's enough now. Go on back and get your car. Except that wasn't the plan. The plan was to go down the driveway, just as I had in the final dream, the nightmare. The plan was to prove to myself that there was no shroud-wrapped monster lurking in the shadows of the big old log house down there. The plan was pretty much based on that bit of New Age wisdom which says the word fear stands for face everything and recover. But standing there and looking down at that spark of porch light, it looked very small in the growing darkness. It occurred to me that there's another bit of wisdom, one not quite so good morning starshine, which suggests fear is actually an acronym for fuck everything and run. Standing there by myself in the woods as the light left the sky, that seemed like the smarter interpretation, no two ways about it. I looked down and was a little amused to see that I had taken one of the balloons, untied it without even noticing as I thought things over. It floated serenely up from my hand at the end of its string, the words printed on it now impossible to read in the growing dark. Maybe it's all moot anyway. Maybe I won't be able to move. Maybe that old devil writer's walk has got hold of me again and I'll just stand here like a statue until someone comes along and hauls me away. But this was real time in the real world. And in the real world, there was no such thing as writer's walk. I opened my hand. As the string I'd been holding floated free, I walked under the rising balloon and started down the driveway. Foot followed foot, pretty much as they had ever since I'd first learned this trick back in 1959. I went deeper and deeper into the clean but sour smell of pine, and once I caught myself taking an extra big step, avoiding a fallen branch that had been in the dream but wasn't here in reality. My heart was still thudding hard, and sweat was still pouring out of me, oiling my skin and drawing mosquitoes. I raised a hand to brush the hair off my brow, then stopped, holding it splay-fingered out in front of my eyes. I put the other one next to it. Neither was marked. There wasn't even a shadow of scar from the cut I'd given myself while crawling around my bedroom during the ice storm. I'm all right, I said. I'm all right. You funny little man, said Strickland, a voice answered. It wasn't mine, wasn't Joe's. It was the UFO voice that had narrated my nightmare, the one which had driven me on even when I wanted to stop. The voice of some outsider. I started walking again. I was better than halfway down the driveway now. I had reached the point where, in the dream, I told the voice that I was afraid of Mrs. Danvers. "I'm afraid of Mrs. D," I said, trying the words aloud in the growing dark. "What if the bad old housekeeper's down there?" A loon cried on the lake, but the voice didn't answer. I suppose it didn't have to. There was no Mrs. Danvers. She was only a bag of bones in an old book, and the voice knew it. I began walking again. I passed the big pine that Joe had once banged into in our Jeep, trying to back up the driveway. How she had sworn, like a sailor. I had managed to keep a straight face until she got to "fuck a duck," and then I'd lost it. Leaning against the side of the Jeep with the heels of my hands pressed against my temples, howling until tears rolled down my cheeks, and Joe glaring hot blue sparks at me the whole time. I could see the mark about 3 feet up on the trunk of the tree, the white seeming to float above the dark bark in the gloom. It was just here that the unease which pervaded the other dreams had skewed into something far worse. Even before the shrouded thing had come bursting out of the house, I had felt something was all wrong, all twisted up. I had felt that somehow the house itself had gone insane. It was at this point, passing the old scarred pine, that I had wanted to run like the gingerbread man. I didn't feel that now. I was afraid, yes, but not in terror. There was nothing behind me, for one thing, no sound of slobbering breath. The worst thing a man was likely to come upon in these woods was an irritated moose. Or, I supposed, if he was really unlucky, a pissed-off bear. In the dream, there had been a moon at least 3/4 full, but there was no moon in the sky above me that night. Nor would there be. In glancing over the weather page in that morning's Dairy News, I had noticed that the moon was new. Even the most powerful sensations of déjà vu are fragile. And at the thought of that moonless sky, mine broke. The sensation of reliving my nightmare departed so abruptly that I even wondered why I had done this, what I had hoped to prove or accomplish. Now I'd have to go all the way back down the dark lane to retrieve my car. All right, but I'd do it with a flashlight from the house. One of them would surely still be just inside the... A series of jagged explosions ran themselves off on the far side of the lake, the last loud enough to echo against the hills. I stopped, drawing in a quick breath. Moments before, those unexpected bangs probably would have sent me running back up the driveway in a panic, but now I had only that brief, startled moment. It was firecrackers, of course, the last one, the loudest one, maybe an M-80. Tomorrow was the 4th of July, and across the lake kids were celebrating early, as kids are wont to do. I walked on. The bushes still reached like hands, but they had been pruned back, and their reach wasn't very threatening. I didn't have to worry about the power being out either. I was now close enough to the back stoop to see moths fluttering around the light Bill Dean had left on for me. Even if the power had been out, in the western part of the state, a lot of the lines are still above ground, and it goes out a lot, the Jenny would have kicked in automatically. Yet I was awed by how much of my dream was actually here, even with the powerful sense of repetition, of reliving, departed. Joe's planters were where they'd always been, flanking the path which leads down to Sarah's little lick of beach. I suppose Brenda Meserve had found them stacked in the cellar, and had had one of her crew set them out again. Nothing was growing in them yet, but I suspected that stuff would be soon, and even without the moon of my dream, I could see the black square on the water standing about 50 yards offshore, the swimming float. No oblong shape lying overturned in front of the stoop, though, no coffin. Still, my heart was beating hard again, and I think if more firecrackers had gone off on the Kashwakamak side of the lake just then, I might have screamed. "You funny little man," said Strickland.
"Give me that. It's my dust catcher."
What if death drives us insane? What if we survive, but it drives us insane? What then? I had reached the point where, in my nightmare, the door banged open and that white shape had come hurtling out with its wrapped arms upraised. I took one more step and then stopped, hearing the harsh sound of my respiration as I drew each breath down my throat and then pushed it back out over the dry floor of my tongue. There was no return of the déjà vu, but for a moment I thought the shape would appear anyway, here in the real world, in real time. I stood waiting for it with my sweaty hands clenched. I drew in another dry breath, and this time I held it. The soft lap of water against the shore. A breeze that patted my face and rattled the bushes. A loon cried out on the lake. Moths battered the stoop light. No shroud monster threw open the door, and through the big windows to the left and right of the door, I could see nothing moving, white or otherwise. There was a note above the knob, probably from Bill, and that was it. I let out my breath in a rush and walked the rest of the way down the driveway to Sarah Laughs. The note was indeed from Bill Dean. It said that Brenda had done some shopping for me. The supermarket receipt was on the kitchen table, and I would find the pantry well stocked with canned goods. She'd gone easy with the perishables, but there was milk, butter, half and half, and hamburger, that staple of single-guy cuisine. "I will see you next Monday," Bill had written. "If I had my druthers, I'd be here to say hello in person, but the good wife says it's our turn to do the holiday trottin', and so we are going down to Virginia, hot, to spend the 4th with her sister. If you need anything or run into problems..." He had jotted his sister-in-law's phone number in Virginia, as well as Butch Wiggins's number in town, which locals just call the T.I., as in, "Me and Mother got tired of Bethel and moved our trailer over to the T.I. There were other numbers as well. The plumber, the electrician, Brenda Meserve, even the TV guy over in Harrison, who had repositioned the DSS dish for maximum reception. Bill was taking no chances. I turned the note over, imagining a final P.S. "Say, Mike, if nuclear war should break out before me and the vet get back from Virginia..." Something moved behind me. I whirled on my heels, the note dropping from my hand. It fluttered to the boards of the back stoop like a larger, whiter version of the moths banging the bulb overhead. In that instant, I was sure it would be the shroud thing, an insane revenant in my wife's decaying body. "Give me my dust catcher. Give it to me. How dare you come down here and disturb my rest? How dare you come to Manderley again, and now that you're here, how will you ever get away? Into the mystery with you, you silly little man. Into the mystery with you." Nothing there. It had just been the breeze again, stirring the bushes around a little. Except I had felt no breeze against my sweaty skin. Not that time. "Well, it must have been. There's nothing there," I said. The sound of your voice when you're alone can either be scary or reassuring. That time it was the latter. I bent over, picked up Bill's note, and stuffed it into my back pocket. Then I rummaged out my key ring. I stood under the stoop light in the big, swooping shadows of the light-struck moths, picking through my keys until I found the one I wanted. It had a funny disused look, and as I rubbed my thumb along its serrated edge, I wondered again why I hadn't come down here, except for a couple of quick, broad daylight errands, in all the months and years since Joe had died. Surely if she had been alive, she would have insisted. But then a peculiar realization came to me. It wasn't just a matter of since Joe died. It was easy to think of it that way. Never once during my 6 weeks on Key Largo had I thought of it any other way. But now, actually standing here in the shadows of the dancing moths, it was like standing under some weird organic disco ball, and listening to the loons out on the lake, I remembered that although Joanna had died in August of 1994, she had died in Derry. It had been miserably hot in the city. So why had we been there? Why hadn't we been sitting out on our shady deck on the lake side of the house, drinking iced tea in our bathing suits, watching the boats go back and forth and commenting on the form of the various water skiers? What had she been doing in that damned Rite Aid parking lot to begin with, when during any other August we would have been miles from there? Nor was that all. We usually stayed at Sarah until the end of September. It was a peaceful, pretty time, as warm as summer. But in 93, we left with August only a week gone. I knew because I could remember Joanna going to New York with me later that month, some kind of publishing deal and the usual attendant publicity crap. It had been dog hot in Manhattan, the hydrant spraying in the East Village and the uptown streets sizzling. On one night of that trip, we'd seen The Phantom of the Opera. Near the end, Joe had leaned over to me and whispered, "Oh, fuck, the Phantom is sniveling again." I had spent the rest of the show trying to keep from bursting into wild peals of laughter. Joe could be evil that way. Why had she come with me that August? Joe didn't like New York even in April or October, when it's sort of pretty. I didn't know. I couldn't remember. All I was sure of was that she had never been back to Sarah Laughs after early August of 1993. And before long, I wasn't even sure of that.